As people evolve, so does culture. This leads some brands to being left behind and forgotten. In this episode, I talk to the MD of Moya App, the director of Hebraism, and the author of Introducing Hebraism, A Guide to Black Cultural Nuance, Donald Mukhale. I ask him why and why brands should understand and tap into culture for growth.
All I'm saying is that my argument for culture comes from a place that says that cultural insights and understanding ought to inform not just marketing campaigns, because that's just the fourth P of marketing. I want it to influence the other three Ps. The other three Ps must be influenced as well based on the understanding of culture. That is my argument. That's where I think the transformation is going to be. So I'm not just advocating for more culturally resonant campaigns. That's just one aspect. It's a no-brainer. Everybody's been talking about that. I'm saying, let it inform your price. Let it inform how your price shows up. Let it inform how your customer service acknowledges me. Let it inform how you decorate even your offices, your uniforms. Let it inform every aspect of your business.
He also shares examples of brands that are immersing themselves to remain relevant.
Recently, Knickknacks came up with a campaign that led them to create a cheesy gouda flavor. So they created a cheesy gouda flavor as part of the product that they created. And part of that, they had an empowerment aspect where they had the consumers buy the SKU, enter a competition and get an opportunity to win prizes and bursaries and things like that. So there's an empowerment aspect. They're creating a cheesy gouda flavor and they're using a local artist who's very much resonant. And their business challenge at the time was that they are outdated with the youth. So they needed a way to come back and revitalize the Knickknacks brand against the youth. And all they did is a very simple, classical campaign of, okay, let's have an empowerment aspect that gives back. Let's create a new flavor that's resonant and really relatable to where these guys come from, which needed research, hence the cheesy gouda. And let's pick a influencer that they can relate to that represents best this core audience.
Stay tuned for insights that will shift your perspective on a potentially missing piece in your marketing and advertising. This is The Lead Creative. Welcome to The Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Monge Zimtati. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Donald, thanks so much for making the time to talk to us on The Lead Creative in your very busy day. Because I know you do quite a lot and you're running around quite a lot, so it's an honor to have you on the show. To kick us off, thinking back to your life and the brands that you love, when has culture influenced you towards gravitating towards one brand or product or another?
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor to have this conversation with you. If I was to think back, it's probably an ad. It's a couple of ads. One of them is a Cremora ad.
Okay.
It's not inside. It's on top. Yeah. You know, the Mall of Shobham. You know, it's all of those ads that just made me feel proud to be black and proud to be seen for the social cultural reality that we lived. And I it resonated with me. So for me, it was when I was younger, and it's crazy that the references I'm making are of ads that caught me when I was younger. I almost struggle to find ones now that give the same effect, that have the same impact, that have the same stickiness. But it's when I think back, that's what drew me to culture and the power and importance of culture in marketing.
So what do you think happened then, between then and now, then when you were younger, more a consumer, watching TV or whatever else, to today when you are actively pursuing marketing and advertising that sticks? What happened between these two times?
I think we lost our way as a marketing fraternity, as an industry. We lost sight of the importance of cultural nuance in driving not only resonance, but just relatability and stickiness. I think we just lost sight of it. I think we were distracted by other things. There's too many other things that have emerged in our world since then. Now it's called influencer marketing. It was used to be brand ambassadorship back in those days. It's just the slight changes in technology. Now social media has become a thing. So I think we've just been too distracted by the technological changes and how those technological changes have influenced consumer behavior. How they consume, how it influenced the way they consume media and technology. And I think we've just forgotten that all of those things are just a means to an end. They're just pieces or technology. They're just ways in which consumers access information. It shouldn't change the creative lens, you know. It shouldn't change the framework or our understanding of consumers and culture. Those things shouldn't change. Like, just because I now receive a TV ad on my mobile device programmatically with DTM tags for days, that doesn't mean the ad shouldn't be culturally resonant. I think that's where the problem is. We've been focused too much on the tech side of it and tagging. And I think it's fundamental to two things. Well, the first is we are at a place in marketing where our struggle for existence is realer than ever before, because we have to justify and attribute our, you know, why and how we bring a return on investment. Sure. That's the first. So procurement and marketing are at odds.
Yeah.
Because of that, we are now measuring everything and forgetting the big picture. Keeping
the person at the end of it.
The things.
The culture. Yeah.
So I think that's the reason why we are where we are at. Yeah. There's just been a deterioration because of all these changes, and we haven't managed the changes well as an industry.
So I like those things because they bring me nicely to my next question, that all the things you've just described point to the fact that we have so much data on Donald now. On paper, we know Donald so much better than we did when you first saw those ads as a young person, and yet those ads resonated so much, right? And despite all the data that we have, brands, to your point, are missing the mark when engaging with the consumer. So why do you think this happens so much? You've mentioned the technology, our obsession with technology. You've mentioned our obsession with the data. You've mentioned all of these things. Where do we miss the mark, and why, when we've got so much intelligence, so much insight, and yet we make such expensive, culturally, if there's such a word, unnuanced mistakes?
Oh, Bogis, that is a very sharp question. I think there's a number of things that lead to that, man. I don't think it's one thing. I think it's a combination of things. I mean, one of them is certainly too many chefs in the kitchen. On the marketing side, the people that make the communication direction decisions are often at odds, usually wanting to reflect a very solipsistic view. You know, they are very quick to be leaning on what they think is going to work based on their personal experience. You know, like creative agencies will tell you this. There are specific clients who just love TV ads. The first thing they do and think of when it comes to marketing is a TV ad, an expensive TV ad. That's the first thing.
Yeah.
Even though the data, to your point, is saying that these audiences don't watch TV like that. They are on Facebook. Yeah. They are on wada-wada. Fill in the blank. They'll still go and start at the TV ad, and then the media must solve for that. The other challenge is we have all of this data, and unfortunately, not all of this data is stored in a way that's cohesive and tells a singular story. Meaning, the data that tells me about Mongezi is sitting in this bucket, in this data lake. The data that tells me about his habits is sitting in a different data lake, and they are not connected. So there's a marketing investment or marketing technology investment that has to be done where the data cohesively speaks to one another, so that Mongezi Mdati, who is an existing Absa customer, doesn't get an advert about home loan when he's already paying a home loan to us every month.
Yes.
So are you with me? So there's also
I'm with you.
Then from a culture perspective, because I don't think businesses and marketing teams have done enough of a job to understand the power of culture. It's almost like even when creative concepts are being explored, nobody's really asking the question around what's cultural relevance here and why that's important. So that cultural nuance check isn't being done at concept or creative stage. It's not being done enough. If at best, and you will see this in the adverts and the quality of the adverts, is at best they'll do one thing that's relatable or is identifiable to being South African, for instance. But they won't go deep into a nuance, right?
Yeah.
So I think the check just isn't being done. So these are just a few of the factors that I think are influencing why we're seeing, you know, such culturally unnuanced things despite having so much data. There's just all this complexity we're not managing well.
So if I were, I suppose, you know, on the brand side in that room with this budget and I were to play devil's advocate, I would probably say if I go too deep into the nuance of one culture, I stand the risk as a brand of excluding everybody else. So making it too, you know, deep in that particular culture. How do you balance it then? Like, given the data and intelligence that you have, which, as you've said, you know, brands do have, so it's not like they don't have that data, why then do we go lukewarm in the middle of the road?
Brilliant question. And the answer to that question is, for me, if your product or service is appealing to the mass or the total population of South Africa, then the culture you should focus on is a South African culture. So the things that make you South African that all of us can identify with, and I can use ShopRite Checkers as an example, is the last campaign they did in December where they were talking about how your ShopRite Extra Savings campaign can help you stretch for more. I was privileged to have seen that campaign because they had multiple character archetypes. They had an old Magogo who was stock failing. They had a colored man who was this. They had a white guy who was that. They were focusing on South African character archetypes. So fundamentally, the overarching concept there is South African culture. That, for me, is how you balance it. That said, if your product or service is appealing to a specific culture more so than others, then you change the weighting differently as well. If you know that 70 or 80% of your consumers are Black Nguni-speaking people, then your cultural concept, your conceptualization ought to be taking that into account and lead like that.
Sure.
Because that's who is, you know, so there's something to be said about making data-based decisions, you know. Be led by data, because we have so much of it, to your point. And then and then move from there. So there's definitely always an answer, is the answer I think I'm trying to say. There's always an answer to that. So even if you play devil's advocate, there's an answer to that. Is let's make data-based or data-related questions or answer them.
Yeah.
Informed by data, excuse me. Yo, the English brand.
It is. No, that definitely resonates, because it's about who you're, it's about, I suppose, who you're communicating with and bravely communicating with those people, because I suppose the bravery aspect is sometimes lacking in some brands, like the courage to kind of communicate with who you're communicating with because of what you know. That said, there have been some shifts in recent times where brands have focused on focus groups, they've focused on surveys to understand the audience and the cultural nuance that we keep talking about. And such traditional methods are in very many ways, or in some ways, falling away. And AI is coming into the space. Predictive analytics are coming into the space more and more. What approaches do you think are really effective in understanding cultural nuance if you want to resonate and be relevant as a brand?
One thing I can certainly tell you is that AI is not at a place to understand cultural nuance yet. And as a hubilist, I certainly challenge all the AI businesses that I don't think AI knows what guababa is, you know? That said, for me, that the critical thing is always to get to know the human being, man. Know sure. the human being, know the consumer, right? There's still power in qualitative research. I mean, the quant is there. We know that. It's standard stuff. Mm. But the qual, I think, for me, is where the texture of the actual segments or audiences really lies. You know, the qual is where you're going to actually unlock the cultural nuances. That where you're, you know, you're not gonna find out that a sack of oranges is used as a scrubber via quantitative research. You're going to find that out through a conversation. So through an actual immersion, through a qual. Mm. So there's power in that. And I think qual is important also because you can update that a little bit more often. You know, if people consume TV, they consume TV. That can be relevant for a while. But the how you consume TV changes a lot with technology emerges. So qual becomes important in that. So the focus group stuff, the immersion stuff is critical. I would make sure that that's a running rotation. Every quarter we have those to really keep abreast of how things are changing. Because language is constantly changing. The way people use the same product also changes. So that's how you find that out, right? So I'd say qual is the most critical. Then the second is, from an AI perspective, AI should be used to just do the heavy lifting of baseline work. That's really what AI is for. And the power of AI is always in the input. So what you prompt it, you know, is what's going to determine what comes out of it. So I say, you know, use AI for just the basic heavy lifting stuff, but feed it in with actual qual / focus group / you know, immersion type research to really get the texture of the human beings of the segments or the core audiences you're reaching in order to be able to pick out what the cultural nuances are so that you can infuse it in the work that you do. That would be my recommendation to businesses.
Yeah. If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. You've also been at the helm of, you know, key marketing and advertising shifts, or rather, as these shifts were happening, you were at the helm of leadership in, you know, out of home, in more tech-led approaches, in all of these spaces. So you've been following where brands have been changing. In your view, where are brands meeting the consumer effectively today, and what's missing in being more effective?
I think where the brands are meeting the consumers effectively today is in the digital spaces. I think they're doing a good job on social media. A very good job on social media on the publisher side. So, you know, obviously programmatic is doing really well. The threat of potentially losing cookie tracking, cookie data has always been dangerous, which led businesses to start, you know, creating first party data and really, you know, try to accelerate their personalization. I don't want to throw too much jargon, really, but I think where they're meeting them well is just digital. You know, the way that brands are showing up digitally is better than ever before. So it's a good place. There's still massive room for improvement because of disparate data sets not talking to each other and having a cohesive story, which is why personalization at scale remains a pursuit. It remains a myth. It remains a concept we all would love to see, because there's not enough. I think, you know, there's not a lot of businesses that have done that correctly, but I've seen some really amazing leaps. Like there's some financial institutions that have done a good job of that. And I think where they're missing, I think, the mark is in consistently understanding how consumers have been. Let me put it like this. There was a point in time where advertising used to set the narrative about how things ought to happen in society. And that power still is held by, you know, advertisers in a very real way. But I think over time, the brands have been less brave and less brave. And it could be in part due to cancel culture doing this. Yeah. So the power of us creating a narrative of how society is supposed to be is then starting to do this. So there's this, So there's a decline in the bravery in ads and advertising and communication stuff. So we're good at meeting them digitally, but we're not good at influencing them the right way. Not anymore, at least. But the power is still there, which means it's just, if we just change the creative, if we just be a little bit braver, we can absolutely change. I think that the challenge also, because the consumer now has a bigger voice than ever been, you know, that because of the emergence of social media, they are able to challenge businesses much more directly and quickly. You know, you've seen when a brand does a mistake and they trend. You've seen a few examples of this when there's a famous pharmaceutical that made a mistake with a casting and there was outrage. And I think that has diminished the bravery in businesses to do a little bit more kind of brave, I suppose, audacious campaigning. So I think, you know, they do it effectively on digital in terms of just media, but they don't do it well in terms of creative and comms and really just being more resonant and being more personal.
I want to get a little bit more into this, right? And I think there's this, I mean, I'm of a similar view, but I'm almost questioning my own view as well while asking this question, which is that brands and creativity have the power to influence culture, to your point, which is what you just, which is in a nutshell what I get. But also, I mean, I'm not sure where you grew up, but when I was growing up, even today, there was a time when culture was influencing brands and vice versa, right? We started the conversation with Molo Mhlobowam, for example, right? Yeah. Like that was a moment in time in South Africa when all the signs in culture were pointing towards looking for more cohesiveness, looking for more connectedness. So you could almost say the one influenced the other and vice versa. How is culture, because we talk about cancel culture as a thing, but also some brands have leaned into cancel culture and they have courageously stepped out and said, we stand for this. Right. And we almost mentioned this. We almost talk about the same brands all the time. And I mean, a good example is Nike. Like, I keep thinking Nike when you mention this, right? Or even Coca-Cola in some instances. Like, there are certain brands, or does the size of the brand, meaning the size of the audience that the brand has, matter in how courageous and brave you can be?
Sure. That's a brilliant question. I think it shouldn't, but unfortunately it does. But I think it shouldn't. I think it's principally incorrect that it does. But it shouldn't. And the reason that it does is because the people who make the decisions, who sign off on, you know, the marketing budgets, they are much more risk averse than the people who come up with the concepts themselves. And I think at times there's a disconnect between the decision makers who sign off the check for the campaign versus the creatives who understand the consumer. So there's always a disconnect there, and perhaps there needs to be more of an intelligent commercial justification coming from the creatives around certain decisions and directions of creativity that can be more understood by the suits in the room who sign the checks, right? There's something to be said, and that's, I suppose, not to upset, but that's why we created Hedonism, because, you know, our proposition is that where culture and commerce converge is that we are able to put in business terms a thing that's generally been difficult to articulate in boardrooms.
We're
able to make sense of that. So it shouldn't, but it does, and that's, these are the factors that lead to why it does. So, but that said, I have to also acknowledge the fact that it's been a very... When last did you see a Coca-Cola ad that blew your mind, that was a massive thematic, outside of when they had, you know, share a Coke with people's names on it? You know, there's been a decline even in the Coke campaigns. You know, and of course, the Nikes of this world, they've been consistent, which is amazing to see, but... But there's been less and less brands who are braver around that. And that's kind of what I'm challenging, to say, you know, as a fraternity, we need to do better. We, you know, where is the bravery? Where is that I want to ask you about
the digital side of things, and I'll get to that because you said a number of things that are interesting, and there are quite a few things that are happening in the industry that are also equally interesting alongside the rise of, call it, performance marketing. I think this point about the bravery and courage that you're mentioning about brands makes me think about the fact that, you know, the Share a Coke campaign that you just mentioned, as an example, was more than an ad. It was a narrative in society. Right. And I think brands that are winning, in my view, because I hardly see ads at the moment, brands that are winning, in my view, are brands that take the narrative slightly a little bit further than just an ad, because I speak for myself and probably the majority of consumers, I'm a distracted consumer. Like, there's so much happening and there are so many brands vying for my attention that I very quickly forget. In the South African context, I'm seeing a few insurance brands that are doing certain things. But again, it's missing that bigger narrative to go, when I think about that billboard, I think back to that ad and I think about this action and I think about various things. So how then do you craft that narrative? How do you craft that golden thread from data to culture to conversations to connecting people?
How do you craft the narrative? To be honest, I don't think it's that much more different than it used to be done back then with pre-social media. I think a good ad is still a good ad with or without social media. I think what we've done now is we've overthought the process, because now we're thinking about how many channels there are. And of course, we have to be media first and media led in a very real way. That's powerful. It's important because there's data that helps us understand how they consume data. So that's, ads or media, that's fine. But I think we've just complicated the process. I don't think it's necessary. Look, I say all that, but recently Knickknacks came up with a campaign that led them to create a cheesy gouda flavor.
Okay.
So they created a cheesy gouda flavor as part of the product that they created.
Yeah.
And part of that, they had an empowerment aspect where they had the consumers buy the SKU, enter a competition and get an opportunity to win prizes and bursaries and things like that. So there's an empowerment aspect. They're creating a cheesy gouda flavor and they're using a local artist who's very much resonant. And their business challenge at the time was that they are outdated with the youth. So they needed a way to come back and revitalize the Knickknacks brand against the youth. And all they did is a very simple, classical campaign of, okay, let's have an empowerment aspect that gives back. Let's create a new flavor that's resonant and really relatable to where these guys come from, which needed research, hence the cheesy gouda. And let's pick a influencer that they can relate to that represents best this core audience and what they stand for. And so this is classical marketing. It's a marketing choke. Yeah. It's a copy and paste. We've seen so many brands use this. Things haven't really changed. We're still dealing with the same human beings. Just because there's more technology for them to see your ad doesn't mean they don't react to just damn good creative. So my view is we must still not overcook this process. Just the formula is still the formula. The dissemination, then, I mean, that's media buying. That then is... based on what the data is telling us, and then you apply that.
To bring everybody back into the conversation, you have to explain what a gouda is, by the way.
A gouda is a South African, quintessentially South African township cuisine, which is a quarter of an unsliced loaf of bread, which has the middle of the bread scooped out or cut out. And it's filled with cheese, with chips, with paloli. I'm going to use this word I love. It's special. You know, South Africa, if you don't know what a special is. Mangola, which is basically, all of the processed meats. And it's got sauces on top. And that piece of bread that was scooped out is then placed on top. It's basically a Gatsby in Cape Town. It's similarly, I suppose, it's a bunny chow in KZN. But that's really what Agoda is, you know. It's Spato in Pretoria. That's what Agoda is. A cheesy flavor. So they took that and they turned it into a knickknacks flavor. That is unbelievable. That's brilliant. It's like a no brainer. 30 years later, why hasn't it been done? Because Agoda's been alive longer than democracy, right? So it's
for sure.
So that's what it is.
Yeah.
Thanks for conscientizing me. I forgot it's something.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So I want to go back to, you know, the social media and digital and media buying and performance marketing parts that you're talking about when you're saying brands are doing well in those spaces, because they really are. One of the things that is coming out of the industry, and you will know this, is that brands are said to be chasing more and more short-term campaigns or more and more short-term wins rather than the brand building. And the campaigns that we started out with and the campaigns that we keep talking about are the long-term brand building work rather than the short-term do this for the sale kind of thing, right? It's yet to be said and proven whether the cheesy gotta makes knickknacks resonate a bit more down the road, or whether it's seemed or deemed to be sort of short term. So this makes it a bit of a short term approach. How can brands balance this short term approach for sales and the long term brand building that makes them memorable?
Oh my God, brilliant question. And there's so much literature on this.
Yeah.
All of the marketing gurus have written so much work around this. And look, the fundamental really here principle is that the only way to know the answer to that question is to first know where are you in terms of brand love and brand equity. And the only way to know that is to consistently do research to understand, as a brand, what are your brand health scores. So you must understand your brand health. That way you know, okay, in this fiscal we've got a bit of leeway to focus on short-term stuff. Oh my God, brand health scores are starting to dwindle at a point where we must actually now start reinforcing brand love. So let's actually go brand long-term, brand health. So this is going to require a CMO who's sophisticated enough to be able to justify these approaches. And again, for me, the tools that help him justify this are the data sets that come with, you know, the brand health scores. Okay, guys, we've done a brand health score and brand health is dangerously low. It's dangerously negative. If we continue on this short-termism, it's going to hurt the brand health overall, which means it deprecates all the amount of money we've built, you know, we've spent building up this brand up to this point. So for me, that's how you measure that. It's just as simple as that. Just what is the data telling us so that we can know whether we can afford to do a short-term kind of stint in this, like let's coming fiscal as an example, you know, versus long-term. But in another sense, you know, it can be random. It has to be based on data. At all times, it has to be based on data. So that's my advice in terms of how you balance those two. What does the data say?
Yeah, makes sense. There's this yin yang that we keep talking about. We go back to the data, but we also come away from the data. Sometimes we lean too much into data, sometimes we don't. And I think this has been the conversation up to this point. Like, go to the data, but also don't go to the data. Like, when do you know when to and when not to? It's a bit of a hard one.
Yeah, my view is, a lot of it also comes with experience, right?
Sure.
Because there's certain decisions whose impact is so substantial that you have to have had data that informs that decision.
Yes.
And then there's some decisions whose impact is so minuscule or negligible that, you know, sometimes you can risk it on a hunch and very good experience, perhaps even anecdotal experience, perhaps even case study experience, you know. So I think it depends on the case, but there's certainly,
makes sense.
I strongly advocate for looking at the data where you are making massive, massive decisions, so that at least in addition to, so you have a data stacked approach. The data says this, experience says this, my hunch says this, my recommendation says this. So that way it's a much more justifiable decision. I think it's, that's my view of how we should know when and when not to use data.
Right. If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. So in your book, Introducing Hebraism, A Guide to Black Cultural Nuance, you challenge existing norms and give a different perspective on social situations and how we approach them, right? So there's this thing that you bring in that informs us a little bit more about culture, about how and when to lean into it. And I think this data conversation that we're having is almost a really good point to start off. That said, though, marketing and advertising, on the other hand, are often criticized for being out of touch. And I think these things that we are talking about campaigns that resonated versus campaigns that resonate today, it's almost as though marketing and advertising in some ways is out of touch with the human being, with the human condition, with where people are today. How can brands authentically embed themselves into culture through their storytelling?
I think it'll always come back to understanding the consumer. Always. It's always about understanding who are we talking to? Why are we talking to them? What drives them? What matters to them? What do they value? Yeah. What do they value now versus what they valued then? And what are they looking for? What are their aspirations? Where do they want to be? Understanding that about the consumer, I think, is probably the most critical. And once you create from that understanding, you will be able to connect with them in a far more deeper way. And I think the thing I'm really challenging, because to be honest, marketing is, you know, we're not really reinventing the wheel anymore at this point. But what I'm challenging that is potentially transformative is that we look at culture not as a way to just resonate with the consumer, but look at culture as a fertile soil for growth for businesses. Meaning, when I understand you at a culture level, I can create products and services that speak to that. So I don't just understand you culturally. In fact, let me put it like this. Most businesses, or most marketers, when they talk culture, they talk about it in a very linear fashion. And half the time when they talk about culture, it's usually subcultures. You say hip-hop or amapiano, which are all subcultures. It's not culture. When we're talking culture, we're talking about human expression. From a anthropological standpoint, culture is the way in which human beings express themselves over time, which changes, right?
Sure.
So understanding them at that layer is critical because, and I'll give an example, Old Buck Gin found that their highest sales come from the Eastern Cape.
Yeah.
And then when we did a little bit of a deep dive into why that is, we found that the reason that's the case is because in the Eastern Cape, the Xhosa people use Old Buck Gin in ancestral rituals, Ukphasa, which is a way in which to talk to the ancestors, right? By the way, another product that's used in this way is Ntsu, snuff.
Yeah.
Right? It's used as a way to communicate to the ancestors. Do those brands understand or know this? And do they know the power of this?
And of course, sorghum, right? Like King Corn, of course.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of these. So that's what I mean when I'm talking culture. I'm talking about really fully understanding the identity of the audience you're talking to and how your product and or service influences them so that you can use those insights to inform your product and service again. So imagine, oh man, I don't want to give away too much, but imagine when you understand...
Give it all away, Donald. We're in a safe space.
All I'm saying is that my argument for culture comes from a place that says that cultural insights and understanding ought to inform not just marketing campaigns, because that's just the fourth P of marketing. I want it to influence the other three P's. The other three P's must be influenced as well based on the understanding of culture. That is my argument. That's where I think the transformation is going to be. So I'm not just advocating for more culturally resonant campaigns. That's just one aspect. It's a no-brainer. Everybody's been talking about that. I'm saying, let it inform your price. Let it inform how your price shows up. Let it inform how your customer service acknowledges me. Let it inform how you decorate even your offices, your uniforms. Let it inform every aspect of your business so that it shows you truly understand me as a consumer and that I can find a home in your business. I can find a home in your... whatever products and services you are actually offering me. And that's like I much more easily pass it down to my family because I feel acknowledged by it. That's what I'm advocating for. And that's my main argument, really, Mongezi.
How do you think brands can shift from merely representing culture, which some do in campaigns, to actively engaging and co-creating with communities? I think you've mentioned communities in the brands that you've mentioned, Nsu, Snuff, and Gin as well, right? Like, how can brands co-create with these communities rather than, to your point, only reach out to them through their marketing and advertising at arm's length far away?
I think the way in which brands can do that is by starting to create platforms where these communities can engage with the brand more often, be heard, be able to share their thoughts, their feelings, their aspirations, their goals much more often. Outside of just the curated focus groups and qualitative research, there should be platforms that are created. So the brands ought to start moving to a place where they create these platforms where they can communicate with their communities much more closely. I think the other opportunity is also, when you do that, the net impact of that is that your CSR campaigns can start being informed by the very communities. Which means you don't have to do a top-down approach of, we think you need your school painted, let's go paint your school. No, it's a, what do you need? How can we cater to that, right? The net effect becomes, we need a receptionist. Let's not use recruitment agencies. Let's actually advertise within our communities, right? So you're starting to create almost a co-ownership between yourselves and your communities. I think transformative brands of the future are ones who start to look at that sort of direction. And we see this with, you know, businesses like Nike, who allow their consumers, they were one of the first, right, to allow their consumers to customize sneakers, a thing that was unheard of, if you remember. There was always some grand designer we knew nothing about who launches the sneaker. But the point, the fact that you can now customize and add your own logos, your own colors, and order that thing and let it be produced and it's sent to you, it spoke to a community. It says, I see you.
Which I've done, and I've never worn those shoes, and I don't think I'll ever wear them. Ah, the pain.
Exactly. So I think that's how they do it, is they have to create platforms that allow for them to build communities and talk to those communities often.
So we spoke about creative effectiveness, or the, you know, effectiveness of how brands show up and where they show up. So we've been talking about this on The Lead Creative for some time now, because of where brands are, because of where the industry is. How does understanding cultural nuance contribute to the effectiveness of campaigns on the one hand? And if you get it wrong, as some brands do, how do you course correct?
Okay, to answer the first part of your question, how does cultural nuance create campaign effectiveness? Well, the cheesy Gonda example is a classical one. It creates campaign effectiveness because the results of that campaign, where they saw, I think, a 200% increase in sales, brand love scores soared, and in particular, when they, I think their NPS scores also soared against the young target audience, when they're asked about whether they would recommend or buy Nick Max's. Hell yes, because it's for me, it's a brand for me, I see it. Whereas that was something that was not the case before the campaign. So the cultural nuance and infusing cultural nuance in campaigning absolutely drives business effectiveness, not just campaign effectiveness, because it leads to sales and it's going to lead to a much more longer life of resonance with the brand and the consumers. When you get it wrong, how you course correct, in my opinion, is that you be humble about it and you show up as a almost a human being who's made a mistake. That's my view. Is you show up as a human being who's made a mistake, who acknowledges the mistake in public, and who responds in a way that's meaningful to the audience you have offended, you know. And so for me, that would be, I mean, it obviously depends on the situation, right? But that would be I suppose a very audacious apology, an acknowledgement of the sin, and a course correction that says that, you know, here's what we've done to correct our mistake, and here's what we're going to do going forward to better understand, you know, our consumers. That's so it's more a human-centric approach is kind of, in a nutshell, what I'm trying to say. That's how a brand should be able to course-correct, just a human-centric approach.
Yeah. So, Donald, I cheated a bit before this conversation and spoke to someone who has read your book and who believes that it's an important addition to the landscape, to the conversations that we're having in marketing and conversations we're having in advertising. More so, the sentiment is that it's important to tell African stories from an African perspective to influence industries, to influence brands, to influence communication and how these brands interact and engage with culture. In your view, because you've been doing this for nearly two decades now, do these cultural conversations come up in boardrooms? Because you've mentioned brands that have made mistakes. We mentioned brands that have been successful. Do these conversations often come up? Because when you look at a brand mishap, for instance, that happens, I'll use social media as an example, on social media, you always have people in comments saying, if they asked one person, they would have known not to go there. So do these stories of cultural resonance, cultural relevance and authenticity come up in the boardrooms that you've been to, in the boardrooms that you go into?
Unfortunately, not long is they don't. And when they do, it's not enough, which is why it pained me and my co-author to really want to write this book and really pin this love letter to try and justify why it's important to have these conversations more often, but not just at a surface level, but at a much more deeper level, because it influences so many things, not just, you know, the campaign effectiveness, you know. So not enough. But I think that the conversation about culture is starting to mature. It's starting to take effect because those marketers that are understanding this are starting to study it. You know, we are getting invitations from some of the universities to come do lectures on some of this stuff. So I'm seeing even at an academic level, there's starting to be a bit of a focus now towards culture and understanding culture at a kind of a much more broader level, because it's been isolated half the time. You know, social studies, culture. I studied anthropology, it's culture. They don't actually, what is the net effect of that into marketing, into business, into product creation? Those nets, those threads haven't really been connected properly before. And so we're trying to connect those threads. We're saying, guys, here's how it's connected. We can see the threads. Why can't you? So not enough of those conversations are being had at boardroom level. And that's why we're here. We're saying, guys, we want to have more of these conversations. You should be having them. There should be a culture person who's sense checking all these things internally before it goes out to the public. So there's certainly lots of room for improvement in terms of that.
Mm-hmm. So, Donald, we ask our guests to pass the mic to our next guest with a question that they leave for that guest. And the previous guest that we had on the podcast is Angus Gibson, a director, producer, and filmmaker whose work includes Yizo Yizo, Zone 14, Shaka Ilembe, and many others. I'm sure you're familiar with Angus. But the question he left for you was, what rights have we got to tell the stories that are not our own? Is he, for instance, able to tell the story of a woman? Is he able to tell the story of a trans person or the story of a black person? So what right have we got to tell the stories, to tell stories that aren't our own to tell?
I think that is an ethical question. And unfortunately, the world doesn't wait for ethics to be right first before things are done. Meaning, stories of other people have been told for millennia, whether or not that right was secured. So if the question is asking from is it ethical, isn't it? The answer is obviously it's not ethical. But does that mean that the story shouldn't be told? The answer is no. It doesn't preclude the story from being told just because there are ethical considerations around it. So my view is the only time it's problematic for a, let's say, a white man to tell a story about a black person, or a man to tell a story about a woman, is if that story is not based on facts. That story doesn't take into account cultural nuance and the actual truth of the story. Mm-hmm. So it is only then that I think it's we are then, you know, reaching dangerous grounds. But if those things are intact, come on. I mean, there's nothing wrong with us telling those stories. That's been happening for millennia, for forever, and some of them have been completely wrong. Some of them have been completely erroneous. You know, to this day, people don't understand that Africa was named after a white colonizer. Yeah, they still don't know that the actual continent used to be Alkebuland, but the story was still told, and nobody, you know, because crying foul. So really, you know. What rights do we have? Well, you don't really have the right, but you can tell the story so long as you make sure the story is truthful and accurate. That's
my and also, I suppose, empowering as well, right? Empowering as well in some ways.
Absolutely.
So Donald, now it's your turn to pass the mic to our next guest. What's the one question that you'd like to leave for our next guest about their work, their creative process, thoughts on the industry, or life?
My question for your next guest is, what impact on business do you think that an understanding of culture might have? What impact on business do you think that an understanding of culture, and culture, of course, in the context of the consumers, right? An understanding of culture might have? That's my question.
Interesting. Interesting question. Donald, thank you so much for an insightful conversation. Thanks for making the time. There was a lot to learn from that.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for the platform, and all the best for the work that you're doing. I really appreciate having the privilege to be able to have such a conversation with you, and be able to watch the conversations that you've had with your other guests. You know, we continue to grow and learn. This is a powerful contribution to the industry, and it's things that I hope will be immortalized, you know, even long after we're gone. So I appreciate you, and thank you as well.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.